Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's radio. Free radio.
My guest today is Oriel Varga, a member of a grassroots coalition fighting the idea of amalgamating 17 independent community legal clinics in the GTA into 5 super clinics. Keep Neighborhood Clinics say the move is driven by austerity measures that are not in the best interests of low-income people. I spoke with Oriel via telephone on Monday evening about the impact of community legal clinics on low-income communities and the problems associated with the proposed model.
Oriel, start by telling us what community legal clinics mean to low-income communities.
Well, community legal clinics are vital for many low-income people. So we currently have 14 in the city of Toronto, and the clinics work with people who have very, very low income. So something like $10,000 a year, $10,000 per year, depending obviously on the number of people in the household. So very marginalized individuals. And many do landlord and tenant law, Ontario Works ODST, some employment, immigration, refugee law. And these clinics, they've been around for many for 30 to 40 years and are really thought of as community clinics. So they're local to the community and work with low-income communities and do a lot of law reform as well as critical legal supports, like free legal supports.
So why is it important then for the clinic to be located close to where people live? Is transportation an issue?
Well, yes, absolutely. And the catchment areas were always thought to be conceptualized as small and community-based. So the idea is that the community really has a trusted relationship with low-income people in that neighborhood. And it's not only accessible for low-income people to come to the clinic, but also that there's a relationship with the people in the community.
So when a person or a client walks in, there is a relationship that's been formed, and they go back and they know who the person is that they're dealing with?
Exactly, and this is absolutely vital for low-income people, where issues of trust is really important.
And are there certain issues that might be more common to one clinic in one area of the city?
This is it as well, that a community clinic that knows its community, there may be certain issues in that specific area, and the clinic that has a good relationship with the community also knows what is happening in that community and is responsive to the issues that are happening there. And sometimes these issues are, you know, if you have 100 people facing similar things, say gentrification because all the condos going up in this specific area, then it may not make so much sense simply to deal with each individual case, but perhaps look at law reform and look at working with the communities to address some of the issues on a more systemic level.
So compare the community legal clinics to the proposed model, the transformation project, the merging of, I believe, Toronto's 17 clinics into 3 or 4 or 5 major or mega clinics?
Mm-hmm. So this is being proposed by the GTA Transformation Project in their vision report that came out in the summer. And the proposal is really, merging 17 independent community-based clinics into 4 or 5 or 14 in Toronto into 3. So this is a very radical change to the way the clinics are conceptualized. If we do look at the 14 clinics down to 3 in the city of Toronto, then we're talking about you know, what are 14 different areas with trusted relationships with a specific community, going down to 3-1 in each, you know, one-third of the city of Toronto. So you can imagine a catchment area. If you split the city of Toronto into three parts, these huge catchment areas will now have, you know, one clinic each. So that's going to be a huge, very, very radical change, and something that has been around for 30 or 40 years, and also, you know, it has worked. I'm not saying that there aren't issues, but it has worked, and it is also a model that is well known around the world. People do point to our clinic system as an example of how to create clinics, whereas these mega clinics are, you know, untried, essentially. Now, the model, the way it's being proposed in the vision report that came out during the summer, is to have these three or four mega clinics, and then have access points at various community partners. And the report is extremely vague on what this actually is, but we're talking about our libraries and hospitals and community centers, which will now become access points. So individuals will go traveling large distances to get to their mega clinics, and then potentially go to their hospital or library for, you know, as an access point. But again, this is extremely vague, so we don't exactly know. Will, you know, a traveling team of law students and volunteers and paralegals be going once a week or a couple times a month to this access point to do intake, or will these community organizations, agencies be doing intake on behalf of the clinics? It is, as I say, very, very vague. However, what it does is it fundamentally changes the way we do our legal clinics.
Sorry, in what way?
Because right now, our clinic is a community resource. It's in a relatively small catchment area where people can travel. They can come during the office hours, so usually, you know, any time during the week, give or take some, whereas this access point will now just become maybe a meeting space once a week or once a month, we're not entirely sure. And how, you have to wonder to yourself, how will an access point speak back to the mega clinic? How will the individuals in the community have a say over their mega clinic? Whereas not right now, the clinics are small. They're supposed to be small. They're supposed to be local. They're supposed to be community-based in the sense that low-income people actually have a say over what their community clinic does. This is a very different model of the way one does community-based lawyering, whereas it's very difficult to conceive how an access point can be anything but a meeting where, you know, documents get signed or a few minutes, half an hour of legal advice is given out.
Is this proposed model just about cost savings, or are there other benefits that they claim will come from the merging into mega clinics?
Well, as far as I can tell from the documents, much of it is rests on cost savings, what they call cost savings. I'm not sure. I would rather say it's funding cuts are behind it, or trying to do more with less, which would be the concern. And I think that if we sort of I kind of went back to the paper trail to sort of look at where did this idea come from. And in my own research, I found that Legal Aid Ontario's documents, they are basically the funder of the clinics. They proposed much the same amalgamation of the clinics and, you know, cost savings specific to rental space. And they were proposing this well before this vision report that came out during in the summer. So back in 2010 and 2012, they were proposing very similar kinds of ideas.
And where did this new model come from? Is this something that they're borrowing from another country, or is this something that they came up with on their own?
I don't know exactly where the model itself came from. Like I say, looking at the paper trail, one can see that Legal Aid Ontario was putting this forward well before the vision report came out. But some people are saying that, well, the clinics came up with this idea independently. They came together, a few East End clinics came together and decided change is needed, and then they did this process where there was some discussion with community partners and focus groups, and then they came out with this particular solution to close the clinics and create, you know, exact numbers unknown, but about 3 mega clinics for the City of Toronto. However, looking at the paper trail, it speaks a different story, right? That Legal Aid Ontario actually came out with ideas first, and then these clinics came together and did pretty well what the Legal Aid was proposing. But just with respect to what other models are out there, certainly we can see from the examples of the U.S. where, for example, during the Reagan administration, there were cuts, similar kinds of cuts to legal clinics that resulted in, you know, mergers of the clinics and the creation of mega clinics. And, you know, at least in the research that I was doing it, people pointed out that this did impact the relationship with the community, made it less, you know, more bureaucratic structures, less connected with community, the community, say, over their institutions. Now, this research, if people, if anyone's interested, is available on the website of Stop Clinic Mergers. You can just Google that, and you'll find the website for that group.
Were any community clinics consulted, or the community itself, the clients that they serve, were they consulted prior to putting this new model together?
Well, this is one of our main concerns, is the process in which this happened. So the process was extremely top-down. So even if you say, well, the clinics came up with this idea, it was really a few executive directors and representatives that came up with the idea of closing the clinics and creating these mega clinics. And although there was a consultant was hired, funding by Legal Aid Ontario, and there were some focus groups that were done, this was not nearly what one would consider as a really extensive process of community engagement and discussion. And in my sense of it, there was almost no community discussion or broad-based community discussion where people were told what was happening until very recently. And it was really the push of various groups like Stop Clinic Mergers and the Deep Neighborhood Legal Clinics that pushed clinics now to do more extensive outreach to the community. So really a process where a vision is developed for radically changing how we do our legal clinics without extensive prior discussion with the public and with low-income people and the clinic users and the communities, you know, that are advocating on behalf of low-income people. And to come out with this plan without that extensive process of this discussion engagement first is really not appropriate. Community-based lawyering especially sees the community at the forefront, so low-income people making decisions about their clinics. So really what we are pushing for is for a process where low-income people are really extensively consulted. And that might take a time. That might take a year, might take you 2 years to be done properly. But if we're honest and genuine about making changes to the clinic system, then it is really the users, the low-income people, the communities that these clinics represent that need to be fundamentally at the forefront of saying what they want of their legal clinics. None of this sort of top-down process and then getting like a rubber stamp by with a few focus groups. May I add, well-controlled focus groups.
So it's almost as if the decision was made and then we'll do a few courtesy focus groups just to get some feedback, and maybe we'll tweak it slightly just to make it look like we actually listened.
Yes, and that is precisely the concern. So the process that we're calling for is quite a different kind of much more extensive process that really opens up possibilities of how the clinics could change. And the clinics don't necessarily, you know, we would rather see, rather than closing and merging, the clinics that have been around for 30 years. Let's talk about, well, some clinics perhaps need better funding, because there are a few points that the vision report makes that is very true. For example, poverty has increased in Toronto, in the GTA, across the GTA. So if we're talking about that these clinics are basically underfunded, then perhaps we need funding for some clinics need additional staff in order to, you know, keep up with demand. And perhaps it is very true that we need new clinics in those areas that require the new clinics. So let's talk about what what is actually needed. So a transformation from the bottom up, where users are actually involved in defining what the priorities are, will really, really get at some of the issues that these clinics are dealing with. And hopefully come to a few proposals that then, you know, the clinics can discuss and we can work out the details. And then the users themselves, the community members should be voting on this, any final proposal. But the way this is proceeding is that the clinics now are being told that they need to vote on this sometime in February, so our deadline is very soon.
When are they looking at implementing this new model?
Well, the story, you have to understand, the story by the GTA Transformation Group seems to be changing all the time, every day,
okay,
and shifting, so it is a little bit difficult to keep track of tabs on where it is going, but the latest is that now the clinics are going to not be voting on the final closure of the clinics, but rather will be voting on sort of pushing it into this direction of closing the clinics and creating a few clinics. Total number is not known, but obviously larger clinics, a few larger clinics. And then there will be a further report that will look at the details and hash out the details, and then the clinics will be asked to vote. However, we're saying, no, this process needs to stop. This is not helpful in this situation. This process has been entirely or largely top-down, has not involved extensive feedback and discussion by low-income people. What we need to do is stop this proposal, vote it down, and properly engage a proper process of consultation, one that will take probably a year, where we are doing extensive outreach, and that whether that's in town halls, and you know, all the users of the clinic should be asked what they want of their clinic, of what changes they want. You know, there could be door to door, there could be all kinds of, you know, trying to town halls to reach the users and the community members, and then this gathered information gets put together into various proposals about how to change the clinics. And that's basically what we're saying.
Now, Oriel, you're with a grassroots coalition called Keep Neighborhood Clinics.
This is correct.
Have you attempted, along with the community, to sit down with Legal Aid Ontario and have them try to address your concerns?
Well, we haven't actually sat down with Legal Aid Ontario directly. However, we have been holding meetings across the city. We're basically a group that is organizing across the city of Toronto, and that's a really large job, getting the word out about something that until very recently has had very little public awareness. So we've been kind of building our group by holding meetings really across the city. We just, in December, we held one low-income families together, and the Keep Neighborhood Legal Clinics held one near Neighborhood Legal Services. And we're going to hold another meeting January 14th, that's on Wednesday, at 7 o'clock. This will be at the main Girard Housing Co-op, 204 Main Street. And we've been holding similar meetings all across the city. So what we're doing is we're basically discussing with low-income people, with allies, what a better process will look like, trying to stop this particular proposal, and just get that community discussion going first. And obviously part of that strategy has been to reach out to, to organize and reach out to, you know, some of the people making the decisions. But we've been doing sort of Mother Grace grassroots work as of yet, because our group really just started in September. So a lot of that work has just been reaching out and letting people know what is happening.
And who's your group comprised of?
Well, we're, like I said, we've been organizing across the city, so we do have a lot of low-income people and people that use the clinics. We have allies and people from different, who are already involved in organizing different organizations and are concerned about the closure of their clinics.
And I imagine, too, that being low income, I believe you mentioned a threshold of about $10,000 a year or less annual income. I assume that most of these people do not have a computer in their homes. And without that access means that you have to do your organizing door-to-door, by telephone, by, you know, the old-fashioned way?
Yes, absolutely. We've been doing a lot of postering across the city. And as a result, actually, have reached many, many people that otherwise would not, you know, sort of know what is going on. And people are very surprised. They have not heard about this before.
Really? These are people who regularly use a legal aid clinic, and they're not even aware that...
They're not. And even people who work in agencies have not heard about this. So, and like I say, now in the last little while, there's a little bit more awareness as the media is picking up on this, and the word is getting out, because some of the clinics now have been holding, you know, their own forums and their own discussions. But, you know, the decision was supposed to be originally made sometime during the summer when the Vision Report came out. So this is only, like, partially because of the work of our group and other groups, like Stop Clinic Mergers, that has you know, more widely gone out that this is even happening.
Turning to funding for a moment, I'm assuming that the lion's share of the funding for these community legal clinics comes from Legal Aid Ontario, who gets their money from the provincial government.
Mm-hmm.
And given that the provincial government is grappling with a huge deficit, perhaps they went back to Legal Aid Ontario and said, look, you have to find a way to reduce your costs because we just can't continue to boost your budget. Does that sound like a kind of scenario that probably happened?
Well, we're not entirely sure what exactly happened, but we can tell you that ever since our organizing, there has since been a promise of new funding by the government. So, which really does go to show that advocating around these issues and saying that more funding is required and perhaps we need new clinics and better staffing in those areas that need it, not closing, but creating more, that message has perhaps gotten up to the higher-ups. And it does go to show that when people mobilize and organize, that is very powerful. So I do hope that we will continue to do that and really call for what is needed. I'm not saying that there may be other ways to, you know, realize cost savings, but we need to make sure that we're not, you know, perhaps throwing the baby out with the bathwater in the process.
Right. Now, not every legal clinic is opposed to these new ideas. Why is that?
Well, this is really a question because the clinics have been involved in a discussion now, largely behind the scenes. And it is not entirely clear where the clinics stand on this. Certainly there were a few clinics that thought this was a good idea, and you know, like I say, with some previous reports by Legal Aid Ontario suggesting that this was a good idea. But since there has been a lot of discussion, that we do see some clinics have, at least Kensington Bellwoods Community Legal Services have spoken out very strongly against it. And more recently, West Toronto has also sent out a letter that they are not happy with this proposal. And there have been other signs of clinics backing off from this plan. There are some EDs that are really leading this project, so they are obviously, and at least the executive directors themselves are in favor of it. You know, my hope is that we will, with the community involved and the community, the people that actually use the clinics, will understand that this is not a good idea, and that has been my experience thus far. That when the actual people that use the clinics hear about it, they are very, very upset about the loss of their clinic. A Parkdale community, there was a forum there where people spoke out very strongly against it. And we have seen similar in other areas where we held meetings.
So what are your next steps? Obviously to hold more community forums, and then where do you go from there?
Well, we are part of holding these community forums is that we're trying to reach, you know, it's a pretty broad idea to reach people across the city. So we're trying to reach the people who don't already know about this and let them know that this is going on and organize people's energies to stop this particular proposal. And our call really is to push for a better process. So, yes, maybe changes are needed. Maybe we need, new things. I'm not sure. Personally, I don't think that we should close the clinics. That's not the answer. But certainly, whatever the outcome will be, we definitely need a process that is truly inclusive and truly bottom-up. And for that to happen, a new process that really includes low-income people and solicit feedback in a very broad-based way, we need to stop this particular proposal. So this February deadline, we need to stop this current proposal, and we need a deadline of at least a year, maybe 2 years, to do proper consultation, where low-income people really have a voice in shaping and directing their local community legal clinics.
Now, you said that these clinics have been around for, what, 30 or 40 years?
Some of them, yes. So, Parkdale Legal Clinic, for example, 40 years, recently celebrated their 40-year anniversary.
So if they've worked all this time, and obviously they're working reasonably well, I'm assuming, for clients as well as for clinic staff, then why the demand for change now, other than financial reasons?
Well, this is a concern, right? That there are financial reasons that are pushing this, other countries look to Ontario Legal Clinics as a great example of how to run clinics. So, you know, we really have to be careful that we're not, in the push for funding cuts or the push for, what they call administrative savings, that we don't actually lose something that has been developed over 40 years. And there are ways to make it better, Like, I'm not saying that there aren't weaknesses in these clinics that need to be addressed.
What kinds of changes?
Absolutely, certainly. We let's talk about these clinics. Some of them have been really overwhelmed with casework, partially also because new funding has not been provided where it was needed, and poverty has increased in the city. Let's talk about what is needed to make sure that these clinics are actually working with the communities on the issues of low-income people, doing the law reform that they need to be doing. But I really highly, highly doubt and question that mega clinics are going to be doing this and doing this in a way that is better. Because really that the fundamental concept of community-based lawyering is a relationship with the community. In order for there to be relationship with communities, because our communities, our low-income communities, are complex communities. But in order to there to even be a relationship, it needs to be local. It needs to be small and connected with what is happening in a local area.
Is there a concern out there that if the mega clinic proposal goes ahead as planned, that low-income people may simply choose not to exercise their rights because they, for whatever reason, perhaps, they just feel overwhelmed by this new bureaucracy? Are you concerned about that?
Well, this is absolutely a concern. And part of the discussion has been sort of leveraging technology. So this idea that if you have 20 minutes of legal advice over the phone, or very short legal advice at one of these access points, or internet advice, that this will be more accessible, but it's truly not. We're talking about people that really if their clinic is not near to them and not something that they can access every day or practically every day, they're just not going to come. If there isn't a relationship, if there's questions about confidentiality and trust because an access point is doing the intake, they're just not going to go.
And
that is definitely a concern, yes.
And explain the importance of being able to walk to your neighborhood clinic, because for listeners who are not low income, they don't live in those kinds of communities, they might be thinking, well, I don't have a legal clinic in my community. If I had a legal problem, I just go contact the lawyer and take it from there, and why can't these people do the same? So explain why it's different in a low-income community.
Well, this is definitely really, really critical because low-income people often are already overwhelmed with the things happening in their lives. You know, they're already going from one side of the city to another side of the city, you know, accessing resources, trying to access resources. Maybe their daycare is on one end, you know, with very little time, with very little, you know, they may not even have money for that token, right? So being close is very important. Now, this is something that has been identified in the Vision Report, that even now close, because of the increases in catchment increases in the catchment areas, the lack of resources perhaps, they're already big and people already are not that easily accessing their clinic. And this has been identified even in the focus groups that were done by this transformation group. So I don't know why we would make it even worse by creating a catchment area of a third of Toronto. And I don't think that the access points that they are talking about are going to be the same as a community legal clinic. A community clinic is a resource base that that community has. And if it is working really well, it has a really strong relationship with that community. And it's not just about doing individual legal assists, you know, ever shorter legal assists, but it is actually doing law reform, which is a very different kind of relationship as well. So if there's lots of issues happening in that community, people are being evicted, many people are being evicted, then you talk about not just the individual cases, but you talk about, okay, what is the strategy? And you're working with the tenants in that or in that community. But for sure, being able to access the community clinic and the people themselves having a say over their local community clinic is vital.
Do low-income people sit on boards at their local, you know, legal community clinics, or how do you interact with your clients aside from the casework?
I think if a clinic is working very well, it has low-income people on the board. And this is something we're going to do when you're thinking about this, replacing these 14 independent legal clinics, which each have their own board with local people on that board, being replaced by three mega clinics, which already in the conception is, you know, a loss of board members, for one, but also an ideal of more professionalized boards. So boards that have more professionals on it rather than local people. And this, too, changes the dynamic. And I can tell you in my own work of going to the clinics and sort of convincing them that this is a really bad idea, I have seen the different kinds of boards. And those that are, you know, that really get it and that are really, you know, connected with the community are usually ones where the people on the board are actually low-income people.
What kinds of things have clients been saying? What are the common themes that have been recurring at the community forums that you've held so far?
Well, people at the community forums are really upset about what is happening. I think this is a recurring theme.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of things specifically?
Concerned about the closure of their clinic and are, you know, upset at the potential loss of their clinic.
Are they saying anything in particular about, you know, what it's going to mean for them if this new proposed model goes through?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
I was just going to say, are there any specific things that they're saying about what would happen if the closures go through?
Well, I think there are, you know, concerns about the loss of a relationship, for example, with some of the staff that they have developed over the many years, and that they won't be able to access their clinic anymore. They'll be too far and too disengaged and too large to be able to connect with. And again, I think the major thing people are concerned about is just that they've been cut out of the process. But somehow this deal was discussed, you know, by the higher-up people on their behalf, and, you know, they weren't involved in the process. The process didn't seem to include them.
So
people are quite upset about this, the process itself.
Yeah, and I assume, too, that that one of the differences between a community legal clinic and somebody who just has a problem and goes and sees a lawyer is the fact that you might go one day to your community legal clinic because you've got a problem with your landlord. The next day you might go because you've been charged with a particular criminal offense. The next day it might be a different type of legal issue. And so you've got lawyers that can handle all these different areas of law under one roof. Is that correct?
This is correct, though. Clinics usually typically don't do criminal law.
Right.
There are some things that the clinics do not currently do, and there are reasons for this. But yes, the idea is that people have low-income people have complicated issues. They intersect. Sometimes there are also non-legal issues at the same time that need to be addressed, and for sure, these clinics, work on these variety of issues.
I'm assuming, too, that there is a percentage of your clientele who have physical and or cognitive disabilities, and mm-hmm. perhaps you can explain how that community legal clinic is able to interact with those clients a lot differently than just going off and seeing any old lawyer.
Absolutely, and this is where really the relationship with the clinic is so vital. The people have a relationship that extends sometimes a decade with their or more longer with their particular clinic. And the clinic knows them and can interact, already knows, how to accommodate an individual to make sure that there's trust and that they're, working together on the issues in the best way.
And so if you have a client that comes in that has a problem and they are hearing impaired or they are sight impaired, you have the resources right there to be able to deal with that.
Well, right, exactly. And that is, I'm not saying that everything is perfect in the clinics and that things don't need to change to make it more accessible. But I would think that relationship of trust can develop better with a clinic that is based in the community rather than, something that is sort of relies on over the phone or some access point somewhere where you're once a week there in that location. But this, and especially when we're talking about technology, and technology sometimes can be helpful in making things more accessible, but particularly when the relationship has to do with individuals who maybe don't interact with the phone very well or interact with technology very well, then that relationship with the community clinic is absolutely fundamental.
What about clients? And I'm assuming that there may be a greater proportion of your clients where English is not their first language. So I assume that the community legal clinic then has people who are able to converse with that person in their native language?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and this is something that Legal Aid Ontario really did put some effort into and was a very good thing, is to make available interpretation. Interpreters, both in person at some clinics like Parkdale, for example, have a good number of interpreters, but also over the phone where that makes it more accessible.
Yeah, so I assume that
this was quite a bit of investment in this, and this is really very important.
Yeah, and I guess that's where the community legal clinic, comes into play, is the fact that if you have a high proportion of say Portuguese-speaking people in that community, you're probably going to make sure that you have a high percentage of Portuguese-speaking lawyers
Absolutely.
In that clinic.
Absolutely, and that's why community-based lawyering, having a community clinic that is really connected with this particular community, is so vital, because the clinic itself can be very aware of what is going on right now at this moment, and that might change in half a year or something, or a year or several years, that might change. But the clinic that is local and community-based is much better at assessing those needs and then working to address them. And let me be clear that many of these legal clinics, the 14 that we currently have, are overstretched. It's not like they are, don't have much to do. They are overwhelmed right now with casework. So making sure that we have the proper supports for those clinics that we do have is essential. I'm thinking that if we go to a mega clinic model that just has a really big catchment area, and we're just going to be trying to do more with less. When really, if the demand is that we need more resources and the resources need to be provided, let us fight for those resources. Those resources never come easily, but poverty has increased across the city. And there are areas that desperately need more clinics, like Scarborough. It is really, unacceptable. There's two clinics for a huge area. It doesn't work. We need perhaps another clinic in that area. Well, let's fight for that, where that is required.
Oriel, any final thoughts before we end the interview?
Sure. I just wanted to invite the listeners again to our Keep Neighborhood Legal Clinics meeting. The next meeting is on Wednesday, January 14th at 7 p.m., and that's at the Main Girard Housing Co-op. That's 204 Main Street in the social room. And for people that are online and on the Internet, they can go to HTTPS keepneighborhoodlegalclinics.wordpress.com. And if you have trouble finding it, Google it, Keep Neighborhood Legal Clinics. And I really do hope people will come out and get involved, because this is actually very, very important.
Oriel Varga, thanks so much for taking the time to interview with Rabble.ca.
Thank you very much.
For Rabble.ca, this is John Bonner. Thank you for listening to John Bonner's audio blog, hosted by Rabble.ca and the Rabble Podcast Network.